I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. And we're really swinging into summer now. It's June 25th, 2013. Beautiful outside in New York City, and it's one of my absolute favorite times. It doesn't last very long, but the linden trees are in bloom. Can you smell them from where you are? I hope so. It is the most fabulous aroma, the most fabulous fragrance, and it's very brief. It lasts about a week. And I'm very fortunate to have a linden tree growing tall just outside of my terrace. And I'm really enjoying that this week. And as I've mentioned a few times on this show lately, it's all about breathing. Because next to food, which is really essential, breathing is even more essential. And why not make it delicious by breathing in such beautiful, fragrant, linden-scented air? I'm happy. Now, I want to remind you, I'm the founder of ResponsibleEatingAndLiving.com. Please visit. We've always got some fun things going on there, making responsible eating and living fun, joyful, delicious, etc. And if you want to chat with me anytime, send me an email at info@realmeals.org. info@realmeals.org. Okay, now on to my first guest, Robin O'Brien. And she has been called The Food's Erin Brockovich by the New York Times and has been named by Shape Magazine as a woman to shape the world, by Forbes Magazine as one of 20 inspiring women to follow on Twitter, and by the Discovery Channel as one of its 15 top visionaries. She is a former food analyst, food industry analyst, author, mother of four, and founder of Allergy Kids Foundation. That's what we're going to be talking about today. A lot more about Robin can be found at her website, robinobrien.com, and allergykidsfoundation.org. Welcome to It's All About Food, Robin.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I was watching your TED Talk on your website, and you have a great story, and I think the best way to share the importance of anything really is through individual stories. That's what resonates most with people. So I'm sorry you had to go through what you went through, but it's wonderful what you're doing with your experience.
Well, you know, I think for so many of us, we have a wake-up call when it comes to our food supply, you know, and for some, it's a really hard one, can come in the form of a loved one with cancer or, you know, a child with allergies or asthma or some other condition, diabetes. But what we're realizing and what I'm realizing is I'm not the only one. I mean, we're really having a food awakening around the country right now as we realize how illiterate we've become when it comes to how our food is produced and what goes into it. And I think the more of us that really step forward and say, hey, I had no idea, and this is what I'm learning today, now, and this is how I'm going to make some changes and do some things differently, then it gives other people permission to do the same.
So just in brief, so my listeners know, and maybe we'll get more into it in a little bit, basically, you were a mother of four, I believe, and your youngest all of a sudden had an allergic reaction, and that started your entire new journey learning about what's in our food, how dangerous it can be, and what to do about it.
Absolutely. You know, and up until that point, I had just dismissed any concerns. I really was not sensitive to food allergies. I just trusted that everything on the grocery store shelves were fine and were safe, and it never occurred to me that there could be a different standard. I had covered the food industry as an analyst on a financial team, and so I understood very well the way the business model worked and how you could swap out real ingredients for these artificial ones to help drive profitability. But as I really started to investigate what had happened in the food supply, especially in the United States, I realized that we were using a whole bunch of artificial ingredients and artificial growth hormones and artificial dyes and all these artificial things that other countries had either banned or never allowed in the first place.
Did you know any of this before you started on your investigation about what was in our food?
You know, not really. And I had plenty of people certainly try to tell me. I just wasn't ready to hear it. And, yeah, you know, I dismissed it as a hobby or lifestyle, the rich and famous, or some kind of, you know, alternative thing, really. And it really wasn't until, you know, I really dug into the business model and understood the financial incentives that were in place by the food industry and why they, you know, why they would use artificial ingredients. They're way cheaper to produce. But then to compare that to what was happening overseas and how our very own corporations were formulating their products differently for eaters in other countries, that to me was really, that double standard was really the point where I thought, you know, we have to demand the same change here in the U.S.
I want to linger on this a little bit longer because one of my frustrations is outreach, reaching out to people and getting them the information they need, because there are so many really smart people, well-educated, that don't want to know the information or don't know the information. And I'm just wondering, since you've been there and you've been through it, are there any tricks, or do we just make our steps, our baby steps? Some people are going to need some life-altering experience that's somewhat painful in order to get there. And is there a way that we can move the masses a little faster?
You know, I think we're seeing it. We're seeing it happen. And, you know, food is such a loaded issue, and it's emotional, it's social, it's cultural, it's economic. There's so many factors that influence food. And so, you know, when you suggest that somebody might want to navigate the grocery store differently, you know, that could be loaded with how their parents are going to respond, how their grandparents might have responded, you know, so it can trigger a lot more than just how you shop. And so, you know, I think one of the greatest things that we're seeing right now today is that, you know, retailers are responding for us. They're saying, you know, we see that there's growing concern over these artificial ingredients in our food supply, and we're starting to formulate our products differently. So Target, Safeway, Kroger, they're all rolling out product lines that are free from a lot of these artificial ingredients. And so I think, you know, it's not something that you can force on anyone. They have to come to it themselves. And, you know, it's a very loaded topic, but I think the more that the marketplace makes these products widely available, which is starting to happen, the easier it's going to become.
Okay, here's another thing. I have a background in chemical engineering, and one of the things that always frustrated me, I realize it in hindsight now, is when we would do these examples in class with a return on investment, and we would evaluate how good it was designing a certain business, but we never, ever include in it the social ramifications of any business. And as a food industry analyst, I know that that's not in the equation either. Don't we need to put that in the equation of a business, if it's really successful, that it should have some sort of social good to it rather than social bad?
You know, I think in a perfect world, if we had the chance right now to redefine capitalism, we would. I think, you know, when it was originally structured and what's called the fiduciary duty of these executives at any company, not just the food industry, any industry, their job is to drive shareholder return. And in the food industry, the best way to do that is to lower the cost of production and use cheaper ingredients. So that's their job. That's what they're paid to do. That's what their board of directors expects of them. You know, some companies like Annie's, for example, take a higher approach, and they say, you know, we're going to be mindful of the fact that we need these consumers and this planet for a while, and that if we, you know, externalize all of these costs, then that's going to limit our capacity in the future. And so you have these companies that are mindful of the future as well as focusing on the present. And, you know, we're starting to see that shift. But I think, you know, legally right now the problem is that it is their obligation to drive shareholder return. And until that legally is changed, it's what they're paid to do.
Yeah, that's the truth. That's all there is to it. I'm looking forward to some new kind of economic system, mindful capitalism, something like that. All right, now let's talk about what you have done since your... since the veil was lifted for you. So you were sitting there with your children. How old were they at the time when this all happened?
Oh, my goodness. They were 1, 3, 5, and 6. And today they're 8, 10, 12, and 13.
Wow.
So much has changed. You know, we've navigated the different stages of childhood. Now have a teenage girl. And very mindful of the children learning to make these choices themselves, that it wasn't some restriction that was placed on them, you know, that they could learn that they matter so much and to really value and appreciate, you know, the choices that they make and how the food that they put into their bodies can affect them, you know, not only today but over the long term. And so it was a real education for our entire family. And, you know, it didn't happen overnight. You don't potty train a kid overnight. You don't wean them from a sippy cup overnight. And so we started pretty slow. You know, we made gradual changes so that it didn't rock the family budget. We weren't changing grocery stores immediately. I mean, there was none of that. And as we started to introduce these changes, it was empowering, you know, and you realize that we're not going to make the perfect the enemy of the good, and we're going to focus on progress, not perfection. And so with that, you know, we were able to really incorporate these changes at a pace that we could digest.
Now, anyone can do that, and all of us should be doing that. But when you're hit with a crisis, there are some things where you have to respond immediately. So was it your one-year-old was allergic?
She was the one who had the immediate life-threatening reaction, you know, that raced us to the pediatrician on a Saturday. And that was sort of the wake-up call, because I didn't even know what a food allergy was, you know. Mm-hmm. And a food allergy is when your body sees food as foreign. And then I was thinking, well, so is there something foreign in the food that wasn't there when we were kids? And as I really was studying that over the first few months of her diagnosis, I really started to pay attention to the other kids, and I realized that there were issues that were going on with them that had not been flagged as being food-related, but were very much food-related. And so, you know, as I started looking at food allergies, I thought, you can have this immediate life-threatening reaction, or you can kind of have this delayed reaction that can manifest up to 3 days later. And so, you know, it was in that process that you know, we really started to realize that that food can have such an incredible impact on the health of a child.
That's the really challenging thing, because some foods will affect us immediately, good or bad. Some will take a few days, some a few weeks sometimes, and some years. I noticed you have Dr. Joel Furman on your board of advisors. And he's one of my favorite. No, he's my favorite doctor, period. And he wrote a book, Disease Proof Your Child, and talks about what happens in the womb and very early on with children that can affect them decades later.
Right. And I think, you know, as a mom, that's incredibly hard to hear, especially when you weren't making or you weren't aware of the choices and how they can impact your kids. I mean, that was so hard for me to hear, because you think, you know, I can't unwind that.
Yes, well,
once you learn, you can't unlearn this. And that's when you realize there is so much that you can do today to help protect the health of your kids tomorrow.
Well, the great thing is that the body is so forgiving. So once you take away the problems, in most cases, the body will totally heal and thrive.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So
and I think, you know, that's the part, you know, children, they have a long runway, you know.
Right.
So there's plenty of opportunity.
Now, what was it one specific allergy your child had or more, and has it continued? Have you removed certain foods from the diet totally?
You know, for her, her immediate reaction that morning was to egg. And then with one of my sons, we realized that he had a real issue with dairy. And so, you know, as we started to sort of modify, you know, there were moments where I had no idea what alternatives there were to cow's milk. I mean, that was all I had known growing up. And, you know, to learn how to navigate the grocery store differently, where these products, where you could find them, you know, it was intimidating. And I think part of my work today is to help moms through that process, you know, to share that you're not the only one. You don't have to be intimidated. There's so many of us now that are sharing this work. And we did. We made, you know, some pretty big changes. I mean, I think the biggest was that we went from a pretty heavy processed fake food diet to food that were just, you know, foods that were made from real ingredients. And that shift in and of itself, you know, simplified so much, because we were eating foods that contained ingredients that we could pronounce, that my grandmother would have recognized, instead of all of these artificially engineered new things that, you know, came straight out of a laboratory.
Yeah, it's pretty scary what's out there. Pretty scary, all in the name of profit. Now, there are a lot of moms that don't want to hear this information, so I'm not exactly sure how you go about your outreach and information. What goes on at Allergy Kids Foundation?
You know, I was that mom, and so I always lead with that I didn't want to hear this, and I wanted to dismiss it, and it was hard enough to feed four little kids, and nobody wants to be told what to do or what to eat or what to feed their family. So I come at it with that understanding of how difficult this landscape is today and how we wish that the rules and the recipe books and everything that our mothers used could still somehow apply to us today. But when you look at the escalating rates of allergies and autism and asthma and diabetes and pediatric cancer, I mean, the game has changed. And I think once you just honor that with complete honesty, then people don't feel like you're preaching at them, that you're not trying to force a change on them, that you're simply saying, this is what I've learned, and I feel that it's a gift to have this knowledge now, and I'll share it like that, as if it's a gift that I want to share. And then people can take it if they want to.
That's right. Take it if you want it. If not, all the best. Yeah. I'm thinking about your kids now, and they're older, and you've given them some really great tools. Has there been any pushback along the way?
There definitely has, and there's been some sneaky stuff, you know. And you know, one of the things that I learned from the doctors that I've worked with is that, you know, acne and different skin issues, you know, from eczema to acne, can be the result of underlying, you know, food sensitivity or food allergy. And in our family, that's definitely the case with dairy. And one of the boys came in with this big spot on his nose and just could not believe it. What is this, Mom? You know, and I told him, and I said, what have you been eating at school? And then out it all came, you know, he'd been getting some yogurt and some granola, which, you know, is totally 100% fine for some kids.
Right.
But for a child that has a dairy allergy, it can trigger, you know, a lot of inflammatory conditions. And for my son, that's what it does. And so, you know, I let them experiment, but I also let them understand the consequences, you know, and that's what we've done every step of the way. You know, you're free to choose what you want to choose, but in doing that, you're also going to be dealing with these consequences of your choice. And so, you know, that's how we've gone about teaching them.
Yeah, I like it. It's important to empower kids with these kinds of tools. And one thing that many people don't realize, you mentioned that you didn't want to be told what to eat. You don't want to be told what to do. Americans, it's in our DNA. We don't want to be told what to do. We want complete freedom. And what so many people don't realize is how manipulated we are, how we're not free, how we're brainwashed by all the media around us, by all the signs and social networking and everything around us. And children especially are so manipulated to purchase things that aren't healthy for them. And it's really a challenge to let people know we're not telling you what to do. We're just telling you to open your eyes.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't want to hear any of that, you know, and I think that's where, you know, the food issue can be so much more than just food, is that you want to believe what you hear on TV. You want to believe that, you know, these agencies have kept it all in check. And they have from their point of view, because they're relying on industry-funded research. And, you know, the federal agencies are in charge of overseeing the safety of these products. They don't have the budget to conduct the independent studies. And so, you know, they rely on this industry-funded research. And that, you know, when I learned that, I thought, it's not the first time that this has happened. This is what happened to my grandmother's generation with the tobacco industry, you know, where you got into this period of he said, she said science, where the industry was funding studies, and then independent studies came out sounding the alarm bells and saying something entirely different. And I think, you know, really that's where we are with a lot of these additives and a lot of these ingredients in our food supply today. And to see other countries exercise precaution and take the lead and say, you know, we don't like what we're seeing, so we're going to get it out, or, you know, there are no long-term studies, so we're not going to allow it in the first place. To exercise that same level of precaution here in the United States, to me, just makes a lot of sense, not only to protect the health of our kids, but also to protect the health of our economy and our country.
One of the things I liked in your TED talk is that you mentioned this, how important it is for each one of us to recognize that we can make significant change. Can we talk a little bit more about that? I know that you had...
I mean, I believe that to my toes. You know, I think we're messaged, you know, along the way, we hear these messages in media and in magazines and on TV that we need this to be better, we need to have a better this or a better that. But I think what people need to remember is that you are this very unique design with a very unique set of skills and talents, and that's what you have to lend, you know, while you're here. And I think, you know, to really say, you know, what are your unique skills? What are the talents? What are the things that you're passionate about? And to combine those things together and use that to fuel your work in this movement, whatever it might be. You know, for some people, that collection of talents is going to lead them to start a food company. For other people, it might lead them to start a blog where they take pictures and share recipes. For somebody else, they might want to start a support group for kids with autism. There are so many ways to get involved and to lend your unique talent to restoring the health of our country.
Yeah, and I really think it's a very individual thing, and it's so important to do it at the grassroots local level where one person is sharing their story with another person. That's only how change happens, and so it's so important that all of us really reflect on that. And rather than complain, I live in a community where there's a lot of complaining going on, very impatient New Yorkers, but we all have to take that energy, that complaining energy, and think, you know, what can I do, or at least how can I live my life the way that I think life should be lived?
And I think, you know, again, it's just that's the inspiration, and all honesty, I mean, that's going to be what's sustainable. If you're doing something that you love, that leverages what you're already good at to help, you know, restore the health of our families and the health of our country. I mean, to me, that is one of the most patriotic things that anyone could be doing.
I'm reading your bio again, and you've certainly gotten a lot of recognition by many famous, respectable people, Yoko Ono, Robert Kennedy Jr., Ted Turner, Prince Charles, and how do these people help move us along to a better place? We invest a lot of our energy believing in celebrities.
You know, I think it's all hands on deck, and I think everybody plays an enormous role. I mean, the celebrities aren't the ones that are prompting the guys at Target or the women at Safeway or the employees at Kroger to introduce a new product line. But, you know, maybe they have a platform that helps educate others, and that as we begin to drive that change in the grocery store, then those retailers respond to consumer demand. And I always say it's all hands on deck, and that, again, you know, all of us have a unique skill or unique attribute that we can bring to this. And, you know, in our culture where we do follow celebrities and they have this enormous power and this enormous influence, they can play a really incredible role, but so can the mom who is seeing every day on the front line what's happening to the health of these kids. I mean, you walk into any preschool and you see what is happening to the health of these kids.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So to me, you know, I always say it's all of us. It's all hands on deck.
Now, I imagine you're cooking a lot more since you've learned more about food.
Absolutely. I had to learn how to cook, and that was a bit of a train wreck stage, in all honesty. You know, I mean, I burnt a fair share of pancakes. I burnt a lot of things. You know, we experimented with a lot of things. And, you know, part of what I felt was this incredible insecurity that I had to do something perfectly or not at all.
Mm.
And, you know, as I moved through that, I thought, I don't ever want my kids to have this hurdle where they feel like they can't do this. And so that was, you know, kind of early on, I thought, I'm just going to have them at the kitchen counter with me, and we're going to learn how to do this together. And, you know, that's what's happened. And so, you know, last night when one of the boys is making the guacamole, he's hands off. He's telling everybody, I'm the chef, you know, I'm making this. And I think that part, to really arm them with the knowledge that they need so that they feel confident. And I think so much of the food movement is exactly that. It's saying, hey, you know, here I was. I didn't know how to cook. I didn't know any of this. I felt ignorant and vulnerable. And, you know, to say that's okay, you know, that this is all of us waking up together, and we'll provide this safe place for people to come together and begin to make these changes.
Number one, find your kitchen. I always like to say that. Find your kitchen. Number two, learn how to use what's in there. And number three, get your children involved and empower them to learn while you're learning. You can't do any better than that. I know so many parents don't want their kids in the the kitchen. They think it gets in the way, and they're trying to do things efficiently and say, no, I'm taking care of this. And that's really not a good thing. Everybody should be working together.
Well, you know, and it's not one size fits all. And for some people, you know, you've got to recognize there are so many different challenges and so many different constraints facing families today. You know, the landscape of food has changed, of childhood has changed, I mean, of families has changed, you know. And so to really focus on doing what you can where you are with what you have.
Sounds pretty good. What's your kids' favorite meal that you make for them? Or that you all make together?
Ding. You know, I mean, we got some pretty avid grillers. I grew up in Texas, so, you know, we tend to grill salmon with a husband from Seattle, and then all kinds of asparagus. But, you know, probably the biggest, most shocking aha moment for me as a mother who didn't know any of this was the crazy success of kale chips. You know, when someone first suggested that kids love it, I just completely rolled my eyes at her. I thought, there's no way. There is no way, you know. And yet to drizzle olive oil and sprinkle salt and pepper on kale and roast it in the oven at 400 for 15 minutes and to have that come out and be just totally demolished by a pack of kids, it really does speak to how, you know, you really can educate these kids and you can really influence what they choose and what they love and their taste preferences, you know, if you catch them early on.
There is nothing kale can't do. It's about my favorite food. But I have to admit, I have never had kale chips. I know that I see them everywhere, and I know everybody's digging them, but I just like my kale unadulterated, raw, in a salad, juiced, in a smoothie, steamed. But as long as people are eating it, especially kids, that's a good thing. Robin, I wanted to thank you for joining me on It's All About Food and for your absolutely wonderful work.
Well, thank you so much, and thanks for the work that you're doing, too.
Okay. Have a great day.
You too.
Visit allergykidsfoundation.org for more about Robin O'Brien and her work. And now we're going to take a little break, and then we're going to have really fun time talking to Kristen Lajeunesse. We'll travel for vegan food. Yes. Here we are. We're back. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food here on June 25th, 2013. And a lovely, lovely, lovely summer day here in New York City. I can't believe how fabulous it is with that fragrant linden tree all in the air. Okay, I know I said it before, but I'm really excited about it. I have with me in the studio Kristen Lajeunesse. And from 9 to Fiverr to lifestyle designer, she has taken her background in marketing and applied it directly to the things she loves most: food, travel, and helping others discover ways in which they too can do what they love for a living. And back on February 14, 2011, she launched the first and only vegan wedding resource website, Rose Petals Vegan Weddings. While she was finding her entrepreneurial legs, she honed her communication skills while working for the World Society for the Protection of Animals and her social media consulting skills with Vegan Mainstream. Before long, Kristen's entrepreneurial and traveling spirit grew stronger, and she left traditional comforts behind and in September 2011 hit the road on the epic, life-changing road trip across the country. We'll travel for vegan food was born and has since blossomed into a growing business venture. She's currently working on a book about her road trip and continues to stretch her entrepreneurial stride as she helps others grow their businesses through social media and online marketing guidance. It's all good and it's all about food. Thank you for joining me, Kristen.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, well, I'm just going to sit back and relax and talk about my favorite subject, vegan food, and learn a little bit about your travels. Okay, so you've been all around the country?
I have, yeah. I'm just wrapping up now here in New York City. I spent the last 18 months driving around the country and managed to get to 48 states and have, at this point, eaten at nearly every vegan restaurant in the country. I have about 30 left to go in New York City.
Yeah, well, there's plenty here.
Yes.
Wow. And you say nearly. Which ones did you miss?
Which restaurants?
Yeah.
Well, I have a list of them. I don't know them all off the top of my head. I've already hit the, you know, popular major ones here.
Right.
So I'm slowly working my way through the ones that are kind of in the outskirts or further away in Brooklyn or farther right. Okay. to get to.
When you hit each restaurant, did you let them know what you were doing?
Not all of them. When I first started my road trip, I was more diligent about contacting the restaurants ahead of time, just to give them a heads up and share with them my story. But as I continued on, it just became a lot of work, the writing, mm-hmm. the driving, the eating. And so I decided to just kind of continue on. And most of the time when I'm there, nobody knows who I am or what I'm doing until after the fact. When I write about having been there, I'll usually contact them and send a link to what I've written about my experience there.
I was talking with a few notable vegans the other day, and we were commenting about how many vegans blog about restaurants or review restaurants, and they're always good.
Mm-hmm.
Are your reviews or are your discussions about the restaurants always good? Because I'm glad they're all out there, every one of them, but mm-hmm. some are way better than others, and yeah. some need to try harder.
Yeah. Well, to be honest, going into my little adventure, I made a promise to myself that I wouldn't speak negatively about any places. So if I did go to a place and I really didn't like it, I would not write about it. However, if you follow my blog posts about the restaurants, you'll notice a pattern where, now I'm kind of outing myself, but you'll notice a pattern where if I really loved a place, I would be very long-winded about it. And if I wasn't thrilled, you would just get pictures. So that's kind of how yeah. I navigated that, because ultimately my goal was just to create free marketing for these restaurants to help them out, not to necessarily bash them.
It's so vegan. I'm listening to you talk and I'm thinking that's because we don't want to hurt anybody. Yeah. It's all part of the whole vegan psyche. Now, okay, there are some angry vegans out there that will do some hurtful things, but for the most part, I think we all really are so excited to see any restaurant out there that's mm-hmm. vegan, especially some of us older folks who didn't see too many 20 or 30 years ago, and now here in New York, it's vegan paradise, the best yeah. city in the world and the best city for vegan food, I think. What do you think? Yeah. Do you have a favorite?
I have to be honest, I fell in love with Portland, Oregon when I was
oh,
there.
Yeah, they're pretty amazing.
And mm-hmm. They just, even though they might not have the same number of vegan restaurants that we have here in New York City, the quality of the food there is absolutely outstanding. And there's such a variety. So it definitely kind of stole my heart, for sure.
They have more restaurants that are vegan friendly than 100% vegan, right? They're really got that whole sustainable, local grown thing going on there.
I would say that they have a lot of vegan friendly mm-hmm. restaurants. My trip focused primarily on 100% vegan only. So I think, if I recall correctly, Portland had maybe 15 or so completely vegan restaurants. So that's pretty substantial
pretty good.
Still. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And in New York City, how many do we have?
I'm pretty sure you have around 120.
Oh, 100% vegan?
But we're including food trucks, juice bars, bakeries, all of it, anything.
Right. Wow.
Yeah. I remember when I was initially doing research, I realized that the entire state of California has the same number of vegan restaurants as the city of New York.
You know, I'm not surprised to hear that, because I spent a lot of time in California. I lived there for 9 years, and then I commuted from New York to California for 6 years. It's a long story. So I've done a lot of eating there, and I go back very frequently. And it's hard to find a lot of vegetarian restaurants and vegan restaurants. Mm-hmm. And it's also hard to find juice bars.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what it is, but they're just not hip to juicing like we are here in New York City.
Yeah, well, I found that as a trend actually on the East Coast entirely. There's more juice bars from top to bottom here than there are on the West Coast at all.
Hmm.
There were some hot spots on the West Coast that had juice bars.
Right. But any idea why that is?
I'm not sure. Also, interesting, Florida has a higher number of raw food restaurants than almost any other state that I visited. So I'm not sure if that's just because they're all running around bikinis all the time or what's going on, but definitely very raw conscious there.
Yeah, no, I think the weather has a lot to do with it. The mm-hmm. weather and the humidity, really.
Yeah. No one wants to eat a bunch of cooked food all the time.
Yeah, when it's hot and it's humid, raw food is great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about raw food since we're there.
Sure.
Were there a lot of raw food restaurants out there that you've been to?
Not a lot. I would say maybe 15 to 20% of the total restaurants I've been to were raw. Of course, I was also being a little selective because I found it conflicting personally to go to them if they had honey or beeswax or mm-hmm. something, because I personally don't consume that. And that's kind of a trend with the raw food community, is including honey. So, so I would make exceptions sometimes and go and just visit if it was the only place on my list in that area. And other times I would just skip them if there were other options around, because I didn't necessarily want to perpetuate, you know, the honey thing, because I'm not on board with that.
Yeah, it's interesting, these little quirky stereotypes that come about. Yeah. But yeah, I definitely noticed that. I was on an all raw diet for about 2 years, 2004 to late in 2005. And I'm not on the pulse of raw food anymore, but when I was, it was really an intense lifestyle, intense focus for me, and being with the raw community, which is an interesting community.
I think we can say that about vegans and any kind of very specific community, right?
Well, the raw community was more so, just more so, but they do tend to like honey. So just, let's just talk about honey for a minute here.
Sure.
I'm really, as I was mentioning before we started, I'm into the big picture. What I want to see, my intention is to rid the world of factory farming, rid the world. That's my number one thing is let's get the horrible confinement, mistreatment of animals for products out of the equation. Let's just get rid of it. Then we can focus on a lot of other things and have discussions about organic and quote, humane farming and raising chickens in your backyard and all kinds of other things. These are all not as significant to me as this big, horrific factory farming thing that's going on. And then there's honey. So it's not up there, but I don't eat honey either, so I know where you're coming from. But we do have a bee situation.
Yes.
And I think a lot of that is related to toxic chemicals that are used where bees are around more than anything else. And we know that bees can thrive if they're treated nicely.
Mm-hmm.
And some people feel they're doing a great thing by growing bees. And why not, you know, just take a little honey? It's not for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it's for you. But it's not as big as the factory farming thing for me to talk about.
Yeah, I agree. I think that the factory farming is definitely a priority because it is on such a mass scale. I mean, I have watched some documentaries on bee farming and such, and it only reinforced my desire to not support that industry.
Well, share that with us. Why don't you think we should be supporting that industry?
I'm trying to recall the name of the documentary that I was watching specific to this, but it just talked a lot about breeding honeybees and the shipping of them around the world so that they can help populate crops and everything, spread the pollen. And it just, the treatment of them in that capacity was really hard to see. I mean, they were artificially inseminating the queen bee to get a certain type of, a woman sitting there in a lab with a little syringe, into the
raping.
Yeah, exactly. And I had no idea that even existed. It didn't even cross my mind. And I was already not consuming honey or bee pollen or anything. And then I saw that and I thought, this is just, it's just as bad. We just don't think about it because they're these little tiny insects and we assume that they don't feel in the capacity that we can see the emotion on cows and pigs' faces and such.
Who thinks of these things?
You got me. People with money, I guess that's it.
So what kind of car were you riding around in during your wheel travel for vegan food?
I had a lovely green sports van, Chevy sports van. I called her Gertie. She was actually named by a friend of a friend at our little going away party. And she was an old lady, so we decided to call her Gertie. My friend.
When you said green, you meant color green.
Color green. Yes. Not green as in inexperienced.
Right. Or an environmentally.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
Superior or something. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I did spend some time looking for a vehicle that I could try to make more green, but my search quickly ended when I realized that I just needed to go.
Mm-hmm.
I was using it almost to stall the process of just getting going.
I want to stop there for a minute. That's such a good point. A lot of people complain about what they want and how they can't get it. And sometimes you just have to go and do it.
Start before you're ready.
Yeah. Just go. Okay.
Yeah, and as I was getting ready to go, a friend of mine and my father actually helped. They pulled all the seats out of the van and built a bed in the back on plywood. We put a piece of foam mattress in there and had a chest for clothes. And we included some blackout curtains so at night we could just, like, close it up and couldn't see in or out. And, yeah, it became my little sanctuary. It was really nice in there.
Now, what about the people that cared about you thinking about this project that you had, traveling alone and traveling for vegan food?
Well, my parents, I think, were a little torn in the beginning because they are also vegan, so they support the vegan message and what I was doing. And they're actually the reason that I am vegan. So I was resonating listening to Robin talk about raising her kids. But they were also a little concerned, I think, about my safety. You know, a young woman traveling around mostly by herself and sleeping in a vehicle at night and gas stations and Walmart parking lots and side streets. It can sound a little scary. And, of course, I even was a little nervous going into it. But the idea of it and just the notion of kind of what I could do to help spread the word about veganism and also just live a really interesting passion that I didn't think would be doable. And just to make that happen meant that I just couldn't stop. You know, I needed to do this. I needed to do it. So I think my resolve to do it really helped them understand that I was going to do it no matter what.
So you were raised from birth as a vegan?
No. When I was 16 years old, my parents sat me down and said that they wanted to become vegetarian together as a family. And this was after my brother, who's 5 years older than me, had become vegetarian. And they were actually worried about his health at first. But they did all this research and tried to kind of prove to him why it was bad for him.
And they
found the opposite, exactly. So I was a little kind of like, eh, whatever, I'll go with the flow. I'm very close with my parents, so I trusted their decision. And so we went through a few years of awful veggie burgers and a lot of experimental cooking. And I give it to my parents. I mean, they did all the prep work in the kitchen and everything. I just kind of ate whatever came out, regardless of if it was good or not. And I probably complained a few times. And then I went off to college and I remained vegetarian. And I actually never really did any research on it myself. I just, from that point forward, I was vegetarian. But my parents got really involved in the local veg community in upstate New York near Albany. And just through meeting other vegans and going to events and festivals and expos, they decided to become vegan. So every time I would come home on break from college, there would be some weird milk in the fridge. And then the ice cream was gone. Like, not the ice cream. So, yeah, and I was pretty resistant to veganism. I didn't see the relation or anything. Vegetarian and veganism felt like two separate worlds. And then for me, what it was, probably 2 or 3 years after my parents had become vegan, I was out of college living on my own, and I went to an event in Syracuse, New York, where I was living at the time, and I listened to registered dietitian by the name of George Eisman.
Oh, sure. He's great.
Yeah. Talk about why dairy isn't necessary. And it was kind of in that moment that I finally heard what was being said and stopped judging everyone around me, and it just clicked. And so, and then after that, of course, the transition was easy because my parents had already been vegan for a few years.
What is it about humans, the way we don't want to
so
hear
resistant.
Things, so
yeah.
resistant, and how sometimes we have to hear something over and over and over and over and over and over and over, and then finally, what was that you said?
Right. Yeah.
Oh,
or we
gosh.
Wait until it directly impacts us, like Robin was saying earlier, too.
Yeah. So. Wow. I don't get it, but okay. I accept.
Well, and that's why we're here, too, right? That's to help right. promote that message.
Right. Anybody who wants to know more, you can ask me. Send an email, info@realmeals.org. You know, I love talking about this and writing about it. And speaking of that, do you have a website? I know you're blogging, but where do we find you?
I do. You can either go to willtravelforveganfood.com or WTF, which, of course, stands for Will Travel For.
Oh,
WTF, veganfood.com.
Okay. Because I didn't put that in your bio, and I'm going to have to update that and link to you. All right. So let's start with the worst thing you had. You don't have to say where you had it unless you want to, or you could give us an idea of the region, maybe. But what was the worst thing you had on this traveling expedition?
Yeah, there was, I don't know that it necessarily was the worst in terms of flavor, although it didn't really have much flavor. But the most interesting meal I think I had was at a restaurant in California. It was a vegan shark fin soup. And okay. I ordered it purely out of curiosity. I've never had traditional shark fin soup, so I had nothing to compare to, but I just didn't even know that a faux version of this existed, so I gave it a try, and it was really just kind of bland. There was nothing
rubbery
to
bland.
It. Yeah, nothing to it.
There are a number of vegan fish analogs out there, and some are better than others. I find the faux shrimp in some places, when you just taste it plain, maybe has a suggestion, but when you play with it and fry it and season it, I've purchased it from a restaurant and served it to people that were not vegan, and they were going nuts over it. All right, so you're kind of being, what's the word I'm looking for? You're treading gently here. Now, did you have any other focus? Because I know I come from, I'm always looking for healthy. I know there's a lot of vegan junk out there, and occasionally I will indulge, but it's rare. And it's becoming rarer and rarer, actually, but I like the healthy food. I'm not into the fried food. I know there was, I don't even know if it's still here, but there was a restaurant in Brooklyn, I think, that served a lot of fried
food swings. Yeah, they're still there.
And I remember when I first ate there, I was very excited that they existed, and I didn't want to have anything on the menu.
Yeah, people go nuts for that place, that's
for
sure.
Yeah, they like that fried stuff. And I think what we learn from that is, number one, people don't know what's in their food and they don't care. And you can use plant-based alternatives for chicken and beef and things. And as long as you fry it up and season it and add a lot of oil and salt, it's going to taste just as good, maybe better.
Yeah. Well, that's what the traditional version is, too. It's just taking something that you otherwise probably wouldn't find tasteful and making it easy to eat.
All right. What about... Okay, we'll leave the worst thing behind. What was some of the best things that you had?
Well, okay. So, the best ice cream that I had. I'm big into sweets, or at least I was. My sweet tooth seems to be on the decline since I've been eating so much of it on the road. But the best ice cream I had was actually at a raw restaurant called Cafe 118 Degrees in Winter Park, Florida. There's another restaurant with the same name in the L.A. area, but this is a different one in Florida. And completely raw ice cream, and it was the creamiest, best mint chocolate chip ice cream I've ever had in my life, with a beautiful cashew cream sauce on top and a chocolate drizzle. It was delicious.
Wow, and do you know what the base of the ice cream was?
I think it was cashew.
Yeah, cashews are pretty incredible, what they can do.
Yeah,
that's like vegan crack. Cashews.
Yeah.
And all you have to do is soak cashews, blend them up in a blender, and pour them on anything.
Yeah. And one of the best overall meals that I had was actually not too far from here. It's at a place called Veg in Philadelphia.
Oh, I've heard such good things about it, and I have yet to go there.
You have to go. It's
okay,
so
I'm
delicious.
Going tomorrow.
It's really good.
Yeah, what did you have there?
I don't remember.
Oh, okay.
it was over a year ago.
Sure.
And I don't even remember the names of the dishes because they were so unique. It's kind of an upscale place, and they really play with the whole fruits and veggies. They don't do a lot with faux meat stuff, which is another part of the reason that I love it so much. But yeah, I remember there was this great appetizer with some kind of shredded mushroom thing, and the dessert there was really good. It was a blood orange strawberry cheesecake, I think. It was incredible. Incredible. They're very talented there.
You don't know until you try it. You don't know how good this food can be. And I did the wrong thing by only eating breakfast today. Okay. All right. So you've traveled around. You've written a whole bunch. Now you're putting it in a book, I understand, something like that.
Yeah, I had gotten a call from a new publishing company. They're actually called Vegan Publishers, and they asked me if I was considering writing about my journey, and I said I was considering it, but I had no timeline, and They offered to work with me on it. So a few weeks into talking to them, we signed a deal, and I officially am working on a book, which is terrifying because I've never thought of myself as an author or a writer, even though I have a blog. But I think the scarier part about it is that I'm not going to be repurposing the blog content. It's all going to be about the personal journey. And, of course, there will be a mention, lots of mentions about the food and, you know, slyly throwing veganism in there, because I would like it to be for a wide range audience, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really, I found that it's really hard to put words to how much this experience changed my life.
Yeah, well, that's the challenge of writing. I know that personally, and you're searching, and it's you really need to go deep sometimes to find out what it is that really happened, what really happened, and how were you moved, and then how do you put it on the page, and then how do you make it sound interesting? All tough things, and a lot of people do it, and a lot of people aren't very good at it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I wish you all the best.
Thanks for that. That picked me up at the end. That's great.
But I think you're someone who decides what it is that needs to be done. You have good intention and you go for it. So I think you're going to do fine.
Thank you. Thank you.
And as long as you have great vegan food to fuel you along the way, how can you go wrong?
True.
And this is, I think, for the most part, a very supportive community.
Mm-hmm.
People want to see vegan success everywhere.
Well, that's one of the biggest takeaways I had from the road, actually, was that I learned that most people truly are good people. The community and the network that developed around What Will Travel for Vegan Food Is Today is really just a representation of how kind and generous people were. Mm. By the time I got to the West Coast, because I initially started over here on the East Coast, by the time I got to the West Coast, I was hardly sleeping in my van. I had couches and spare bedrooms and free meals. And I lived entirely off of donations while on the road. And again, just that alone speaks volumes to how kind people are. Even people I met and had dinner, shared meals with people who weren't vegan at all. They just heard about the journey and they were so interested and kind of captivated by this crazy thing that someone was doing. So, yeah, very cool stuff.
Well, I want to think that most of us are good, no matter what it is we eat.
Yes.
I want to believe that. I want to believe there's good in all of us, although sometimes it's challenging to believe that, but I really believe that. I think we're all kind of moldable. That's the human spirit, actually. And the more we allow, open ourselves up to learn about things, the more putty-like and flexible we are, and we can become better.
Yes. We just have to be ready for it in that moment, you know, which just speaks to what we were talking about earlier with resistance early on and not wanting to be told what to do. But I think it's almost specific to food, too. I feel like there's a very unique relationship that we have with food. It's very community oriented. So taking that away from people can be scary.
Yeah.
So even though I think we're all inherently good and we want to do well for ourselves and the people around us and the environment, sometimes it can be hard when we're told that what we've been doing is wrong.
All right. So now we just have like 3 minutes left. What are your favorite foods other than ice cream?
Right. Yeah, definitely sweets. I'm a sucker for anything from vegan treats, actually.
Oh, fabulous. Yeah, we've
They're
been
so
there.
Good. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm also like you. I'm a big fan of kale. I will eat it in any form. And actually, just the other day when you were talking about kale chips earlier, I had just enjoyed some very nice kale chips from MOB in Brooklyn. Really good vegan restaurant there. Yeah, I think kale is my favorite food. And actually, I'm intending to try to be mostly raw once I finish eating my way through New York City, just because honestly the fake meat stuff that I had on the road and the sweets, it really did a number on my body. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I know I've been vegan for a long time, over 25 years, and my tastes have definitely changed as my knowledge has changed, as the food has changed. And there was a period when I was crazy for meat analogs. I just loved them. And I know there are some people, vegans, that will raise an eyebrow and say, you know, why is it you're eating meat analogs? You know, why do you like the taste of meat? And I never thought of it as meat. I never thought of it as the taste of meat. There's just, you know, a nice chew and it had that salty, fatty, whatever flavor, and it was fun. Mm-hmm. That's all. But I'm over it now, and I prefer whole, minimally processed foods at this point. And you know, occasionally I'll like a piece of cake, but I never like it when it's too sweet.
Mm-hmm.
Although vegan treats,
they'll get ya.
Yeah, they are pretty amazing. And then, you know, sometimes when I indulge because I'm at a place that I've heard a lot about and I want to try everything, there's that need to afterwards to cleanse, and the body's just screaming, kale me, just give me kale.
Yeah.
I have to say, I'm feeling a little selfish. I just had this little fear. I don't know why I did, but I thought, if I keep pushing kale, are we going to run out of kale? Is there not going to be enough kale to go around for everybody?
I don't think we have to worry about that anytime soon.
Yeah, I think so. But we need to start growing more kale because people should be eating a lot of it. Okay. Was there any one? We have like less than a minute, but favorite kale recipe? Kale chips? Is that what it is?
I actually really like it kind of just rubbed with salt and then put some lemon, like fresh lemon juice on it and just straight up like that, like a kale salad, fresh.
Yeah, kale salad. Mm-hmm. Love it. Yeah. I'm going to get me some right now. Well, Kristen, thank you so much for joining me on It's All About Food. All the best with Will Travel for Vegan Food.
Thank you.
And that's WTVF.
WTF.
WTF.
We'll travel for vegan food.
Okay, very good. Well, I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. Thank you so much for joining me. And I hope you've had a delicious hour with me. I know I have. And keep it delicious. Have a delicious week. Bye-bye.